This is KBOO's The Voice of the Middle East. صوت الشرق الأوسط من إذاعة كيبو و صدای خبر میانه از رادیو KBOO.
طلوا حبابنا طلوا نسيبنا بين ربوعنا خلوا ضحكة سهرات جوال وطلوا حبابنا طلوا بالفيات غنينا وعلى مياه لقينا على أقصى ما خلوا من زهد الطير الشال نحن حكايات في بال منا نغمات موالو نحن حكايات
صلى صلى
أوف نحن حكايات في بال منا نغمات موالو لما الناس مات نحلاله بين الغابات بينات لما الناس مات نحلاله بين الغابات بينات طل حبابنا طل
Welcome to another installment of Voices of the Middle East. This is Gudar Zaktadari, your host. For tonight, we are going to have two different segments. In the first segment, we will be covering the elections in Iran that's going to happen next Friday. And I have a distinguished guest with me to talk about the elections in Iran. He was actually one of the people who signed up for election and was a candidate, but was disqualified by a body which is basically appointed body called Guardian Council. We'll be discussing this issue with Dr. Amir Ahmadi, who's a professor of development at Rutgers University, in a few seconds. And before we get there, I would ask you to enjoy a little piece of music, and we'll be back in a second. Well, I have Professor Hushang Amir Ahmadi, a professor of development at Rutgers University. He's also a director of Middle East Studies at that university. He was one of the candidates for the ninth presidential election in Iran, but was disqualified by Guardian Council. And it's a pleasure to have Dr. Amir Ahmadi with us today. Welcome to the show, Hushang.
No, thank you very much, Gudar. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Let's start with a basic, like Iranian election 101. What are the steps and how this has happened in the past 25 years as far as the election goes, and how do you characterize it, so to speak? Is it a form of election as we know it in the West, or it's a special treatment?
Well, in the earlier stages after the revolution, obviously the elections were very much influenced by the revolutionary process and by the personalities involved in that revolution, and they were popular, and therefore they would win the elections, and there was no space for others to compete. For example, the first and the second, the first president, Bani Sadr, was basically endorsed by Ayatollah Khamenei, the founder of the republic, and because of that, he was unanimously elected. And then the second, also Rajai, and basically followed a similar line, although Rajai really was not originally elected. He was replaced Bani Sadr, who escaped the country. Thereafter, you know, Khamenei, who was one of the main leaders of the revolution, got elected popularly, and then Rafsanjani followed, and so on. So, bottom line, I think the earlier stages, the election was not very normal. It was the personality elections, and if a person endorsed by a leader, he would certainly be elected. Things have changed since 1997. 1997 was a turning point, I think, in the history of elections in the Islamic Republic. For the first time, a supposedly underdog surprised not only the Iranians and the Iranian, particularly the leadership, but also the world by being elected unanimously by the people. And that's President Mohammad Khatami in the first term of his presidency. And he ran against an establishment candidate who was endorsed by the leader of the revolution and many more, but obviously he was defeated, and defeated in a way that that most people, at least in the revolutionary side, wouldn't expect that. So I think with that turning point, elections have become increasingly an unknown quality in the Islamic Republic and an unforeseen event, or difficult to foresee event, I may say. The what has happened since is that the elections have become more serious. People take it more seriously, either those who like it or those who don't like it. Both sides take it seriously, but in the meantime, on all of these elections, I wouldn't call them free elections. They are very different from the elections in the West, the U.S. in particular, in two respects. First, the screening process is quite different. In the U.S., obviously, we have primaries, and then the two parties come with their nominees, and if there is an independent, would also join. But basically, the screening is done largely to the people and the party. In Iran, that's not the case. The screening is largely done by the by a body called the Council of Guardians, which is an appointed body of six clerics or clergy, that is, and six religiously oriented or religious in a way lawyer. Both groups together, 12, are appointed. Six of them, the clergy, by the leader, and the other six by the parliament. But they are in fact introduced to the parliament by the judiciary system, the head of the judiciary system, that is. Well, so that doesn't make the election quite free, because this body of the that is the Council of Guardian is quite biased in favor of the religious people and very, very tough and very biased against the. Against the secular groups and anyone who may have an independent mind or program relative to the establishment. Besides, I think originally in the Islamic Republic, elections were, as I said, very popular, and the population participating in the election was quite high percentage wise. They were they have ranged from 80% of the voting population to around 60-some%. This particular election, however, I think is a different one. I believe this would be another turning point in the history of election in this in Iran, in the sense of the way the Guardian Council has vetted the candidates, but largely, particularly in terms of the participation. I believe this will have the lowest participation ever of the presidential election. So it wouldn't be, it would not be as legitimate an election as the previous ones were. But nonetheless, I think this election would indeed bring at least 45-50% of the population to the voting boxes. And this is relative to the U.S. is high, but relative to Iran, it is not. In fact, relative to most developing countries, it is not. But relative to developed societies, obviously this is a good number. But I think in Iran also, the election is increasingly maturing in the sense that more people are taking elections for granted, and they are not too enthusiastic about it, just the way we have it in this country.
As far as the number of participation, you mentioned that it's going to be less than certainly previous elections, but also not in high numbers or probably less than 50%. Is there any reason for that, decline of number of people who are attending, in, especially for people who don't follow closely the elections in Iran? In the past two elections, for the council, city councils, and for the legislature, Majlis, there has been this decline of number and also the higher, I guess, vetting process or more stringent. Do you see any relation with that?
Yeah, I think there are three reasons one could give. One is that the people dislike this vetting process, this screening process by the Council of Guardians. They don't think that this is a free election. This is an election that is made up by the establishment, and that they don't want it to be a part of a game that the regime sets for them to play. Second, I think they are very disappointed with President Khatami's government and the low level of achievement relative to expectation that the people had been given. They participated in the previous two elections in large numbers. They had expected President Khatami to stay the course of the reform and deliver on the promises he had made. But obviously he did not do much of what he promised to do, and the people got very, very disappointed. So I think that's another factor. And the third factor is, as I said, is the issue of the elections maturing in Iran. I think in all societies, elections tend to, when they start after a transition process, in the beginning of a democratic process, in the first few elections, the people are very enthusiastic about the elections and they participate in big numbers. But gradually, they take the process for granted and the number declines. And that's exactly why we can explain the low turnout for elections in this country or in Europe. So generally speaking, democracies or even made-up democracies or democracies that are really controlled, like in the case of Iran, that's a society where the election is very much like control. Even there, a good number of people are not participating just simply because they take elections for granted. So there is a factor of maturity as well playing that. So I think because of the screening process, because of the disappointment, and because of the maturity of the election process, I think the numbers this time will be lower than the previous time. But I would give the disappointment factor, a larger sort of like weight for the low turnout this time that we expect.
The next question I want to ask is, obviously after that screening and vetting process, now there are 8 people running, and three or four of them are former military generals. And there's President Rafsanjani, who is a former president for 2 terms. Then there is a former Speaker of the House, and then 2 reformist candidates. How do you evaluate, first, the presence of military men in this group, and do you have any precaution for them being involved and in the future of the country if one of them gets elected?
Yeah. Well, first, unfortunately, the Iran's sort of security environment is quite militarized, and that Iran now lives in a region where all over the country is military. The U.S. is in Afghanistan, is in Iraq, and then there are problems in every other side of the country. So the strategic environment of Iran is quite sort of like militaristic and security dominated. And that I think that's one major reason why military personnel or military generals in Iran they have got into this politics. They increasingly they have become vocal in politics and have wanted to participate in politics, and they have participated in politics in the past. And in fact, a good number of deputies in the Iran's 7th parliament are from the Revolutionary Guard. So it's not only unfortunate that that they should be becoming increasingly active in politics, but the good news is, of course, is that so far they are active in politics as civilians and not as military people. That is to say, the military in Iran or the military people in Iran who are participating in politics are not presenting themselves as generals running for elections, but rather as civilians running for elections. And this makes them different, or the country makes the... Hello? Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, you are there, I'm sorry. Yeah. This makes them be different from the... like Turkey or Pakistan, where military enters as military general into either coup elections or what. But at the same time, I think it's not a healthy trend for them to get into politics, particularly because even if they are running as civilians, they are still very closely connected to the Revolutionary Guard and to the army, and therefore the general public does not make the distinction between their civilian presence in the streets and their previous military job. And
let me just give a brief information for our listeners who are not familiar with the situation in Iran. Right after the Islamic Revolution in 1979, basically the revolutionary government dismantled the formal army and air force, at least on the higher level. So they either retired or fired or in some cases execute the high-ranking generals in the military and navy and Air Force. And then they started building a parallel Revolutionary Guard, which in effect had all those 3 branches of regular military forces. And this parallel still exists. And but those who went to Revolutionary Guard basically came from Revolutionary Forces and stayed there. And some of them gradually became civic servants and became ministers and got involved also in kind of commercial activities, even when they were in position in Revolutionary Guard. And some of these folks who are now running for presidents are from that generation of generals who have been very, I guess, active in economy, parallel to what government does in a pseudo government, so to speak. But they're not accountable by the legislator or the regular general accounting offices. The next question I have is, in your campaign literature, Dr. Amir Ahmadi, you mentioned that you are one of the. Could you explain why did you emphasize so much on U.S.-Iran relations and how you would be able to solve the problem and not the rest of these candidates?
Well, I think you're right. I had 4 points, a 4-point program as a candidate. The point number one was that if I get elected, I would put the normalization of U.S.-Iran relations on top of the agenda, and that the week after I'm elected, I will take a trip to Washington and meet President Bush and start negotiating a deal with this with the U.S. administration. Why I think it is so important to establish U.S.-Iran relations is there are several reasons for that. First, obviously, is that the U.S. and Iran used to be two friends, and that both used to benefit from that friendship. And over the last 25 or 6 years, that situation has changed, and that both sides are losing big time, and particularly Iran has suffered tremendously, economically, politically, and so on. And I think it is the time has come for the two really mend relations and become partners again, because the partnership would benefit both of them. But more than that, it would also benefit the region as a whole, and that's great for everybody. Now, this benefit, I think, has several sides to it. I believe until and unless U.S. and Iran have normalized relations, Iran cannot become democratic unless there is another revolution that will change the system, and God knows what will come out of it. In fact, over the last 30 years, some 30 dictatorships have become democracies, and all of them, without exception, have had normal diplomatic ties with the United States of America. And at the same time, during the same period, 7, 8, or 10 countries which were dictatorships and have not become democracies, none had relations with the United States. So to me, having relation with the U.S. is at least a condition. It's not an, it is a necessary condition, although it is not a sufficient condition, because we have also countries that have relations with the U.S. and are not democratic as yet. So it is necessary but not sufficient. But I think that necessary condition has to be met for Iran to make the move toward democracy. And second, Iran to me is looked like a room that is locked. The door has been locked for some 20-some years. And the key, I believe, is in the hands of the United States. I believe we need to get that key from the U.S., open the door, and let the fresh air, okay, move in and out. And until this door is open and the fresh air gets in and out, we will not be doing much in the country, particularly economically. I believe, opening to U.S. will mean also opening to the international community, markets, investment markets, and technology markets, and management markets, and so on. And I think Iran needs all of that. Back in Iran, a lot of good people. We have a lot of good workers and people who are well educated. Unfortunately, there is little, capital. There is little technology. There is little management skills. And opening to the U.S. will, in fact, open the door to all of this. And which the most important part of which is Iranian Americans in this country. That hundreds of thousands of Iranian Americans who could return to Iran and become again very useful to that country. But in terms of the human and capital resources that they have. And finally, I think establishing U.S.-Iran relation is part of, I think, intercultural and intercivilizational processes that must be in place between the two great nations of Iran and the United States. I think the two governments have stood over the last 25 years between the two civilizations and between the two cultures and the two peoples and have prevented them from coming together and becoming partners and friends and so on together. And I think that's not something that we should allow to continue. So I think I could have gone through a lot of reasons, but I think politically, economically, and culturally, I think we have enough reason to look for this. And then again, I mean, the people who are not for U.S.-Iran relations, they are of two groups. One group basically argues that establishing relation between U.S. and Iran would prolong the life of dictatorship in Iran. In a way, this group argues that America indeed reinforces dictatorship. I don't believe it. I don't believe that the United States prolongs the life of dictators, and I don't believe that they reinforce dictatorships. There was a time before, I believe, during the Cold War, that at times was the case. But unfortunately, we only remember those days, but we don't remember recent years when the United States have really been the main force in destroying dictators and developing democracies throughout the world. So, again, one group argues that U.S. should not establish relation with Iran because the United States will then cause this dictator to continue on to survive. I think this is a very anti-American position to take. The second group, who is against normalization of relation between U.S. and Iran, sees the United States as an instrument of its politics. That is, they basically think that the U.S. Army is just like a hammer in their hands, or should be a hammer in their hands, to destroy the head of the Islamic Republic. It's just like, what the Shalabis and the Alawis did in Iraq. They think that that the United States should not establish relation because if it happens, then that instrument will be removed from their power game. So again, I think this is also quite an anti-American position to take, because I don't think that anybody out there, particularly the Iranians, should be thinking of the America or its people or its military as an instrument of their dirty work in Tehran. And that's very unfortunate. But there is a group, there are several groups who think this way. They don't say so openly that I am saying, but that's what exactly they are in terms of their thinking. So again, I'm against both. I'm against this idea that America reinforces dictatorship, and I'm against using America as a tool to change regime in Tehran. I think the Iranian people are capable of changing the regime if they want, or reforming the regime if they want, and that Iran, incidentally, is a revolutionary country, and almost every revolution that has happened in Iran, it has happened independent of outside world. And indeed, if anything, the outside world have never had a positive role. They always had a negative role in revolutions in the country. So I think it will be useful for the foreign forces and for the America in particular to stay out and let the dynamism of the Iranian society play itself out. And I'm almost certain that that dynamism will indeed play out this time in favor of the people. There is absolutely no way that this regime can survive the way it is, okay, unless it changes significantly toward a more democratic society. And I do believe that it will happen. I'm quite an optimistic person. And that's one reason I got into this election, is because I do believe that the way forward is through free elections, and I mean free elections and not just this made-up elections. And I wanted to use this election process to make a statement. And the statement was that, listen, this is a place where we have to have free elections, and if there is no free election, we have to fight for it. And indeed, it was very successful, tactically speaking, to put that agenda on the table for the Iranian people. And I think I was very successful back in Iran, particularly. You know, my open letter to Council of Guardian is now published in Tehran. In Tehran, which is a very, very strange that an open letter of that sort could be even published in Tehran. It has been published in Tehran in two newspapers now, and I'm sure it's going to have to be published more and more in the near future. So It is good that so far U.S. and Iran have not fought, and I think it would be bad if they get engaged in any level of war. I have spent the last 15 years to prevent that, and I'm going to stay the course until the two become partners again.
For those who have joined us, I'm talking to Professor Hushang Amirahmadi from Rutgers University. He's also the president of Iranian-American Council, which is... in their word, is an organization who's trying to facilitate a sound and better relation between two countries. Dr. Amir Ahmadi, we have about 5 to 6 minutes left. I'd like to ask you your opinion, especially with the situation of nuclear negotiation between European countries and Iran, and also a move that U.S. did in the past 2 weeks, first to allow the membership application of Iran in WTO to go through, and the second one was yesterday when Secretary Rice announced, after meeting with Foreign Secretary of Germany, Joschka Fischer, that U.S. is ready to allow purchase of passenger airplane equipment from Iran, which was banned for the past 25 years. What's your opinion on the future of this administration negotiation with whoever becomes president in Iran? And if you see any difference within the candidates who are running, or within the factions that are running for presidency in Iran, if there would be any change, or if there would be any difference as far as how they can deal with the U.S.?
Yeah. First, I'm very pleased with this developments. I look forward to more developments of the sort between U.S. and Iran. At the same time, I will have to caution, the over optimism on this situation, because all of this small steps are directed toward Iran with a particular expectation. And the expectation is that Iran stops enrichment altogether and forever. And obviously that's a demand that U.S. has, and that's the process that U.S. wants to encourage on the Iranian side. I do believe that certainly Iran does not need to develop a bomb, and that's the time of the bomb is already gone. As far as the enrichment goes, I believe the Islamic Republic has made a major mistake by abusing its own right, and that is the right to enrichment. By abusing, I mean they did it, undercover. They did it behind the scene. They did it behind the back of the International Atomic Agency, and so on. And I think, as a result, the international community has very little trust on the Islamic Republic at this point, and that's not good. I think it is good that the Islamic Republic has stopped enrichment altogether indefinitely, and that my hope is that that indefinite continues until the trust is back to the Iranian people. That will take a long time. But in the meantime, it is good that the U.S. government is giving the small little carrots that it has to Iran. But as far as first, I have to say that the selling the spare parts of our airplanes, civilian planes, is not the first time after 25 years. A few years ago, the Clinton administration also allowed that to happen. So they authorized. The Iranian fleet is very much like American, and that unfortunately they are extremely unsafe. And also Iran hasn't been able to purchase any new civilian planes from Europe or the U.S. because of the U.S. sanctions. So the situation is very dangerous, and it requires, I think, immediate humanitarian attention, really. It is no more a commercial matter. It is humanitarian that the U.S. sells this spare parts. And beyond the spare parts, the U.S. sells, I think, the real planes that Iran needs. So my hope is that very soon we will witness selling jets to Iran as well for civilian use. But I think these are the steps that are very useful. I encourage them, and our council, the American-Iranian Council, is very enthusiastic about all this, and we are very proud to be a part of this process. But in Iran, I think, again, let me take also credit for something that has happened in Iran. My candidacy had a major impact on making this U.S.-Iran relation an issue, a national issue. And in fact, I am honored to say that I was able to put the discussion on normalization of U.S.-Iran relations on the election agenda. Before me, nobody did this, and when after I did it, gradually everybody came to this side, including Mr. Rafsanjani and later on Mr. Moeen. Even the conservatives now somehow speak in terms of mending U.S.-Iran relations being a priority, if not top, but it is a priority down, somewhere down the line. So I think, I believe, certainly neither, I don't think that the conservatives will have a chance in this election. I believe this election at the end is between Mr. Moeen and Mr. Rafsanjani, and I believe both of them are prepared to involve in negotiation with the U.S. But I must also say this, and this is important, that neither of the two gentlemen can actually negotiate U.S.-Iran relations unless and until they really use the people of Iran. And that's what I had promised to do. And that is to say, if I had become president, I would have put the U.S.-Iran relation on the top of the agenda. I would have asked the Iranian people if they want this to happen, and if they had said yes, it would have gone. And I think both Rafsanjani and Moin have no other choice but to actually do the same, that is, to put that on the table, and then say, listen, we need to normalize, we have to negotiate, and we wanted to see if there is any problem with this, and if the leader was to stand in the way of normalization, then that the president would call on the people for a referendum or for the street demonstrations or what. But I think it is critical that they use the people for this, and the reason I say the people is because several public opinion polls in Tehran and elsewhere has shown that some 80%, I don't know, 85, 82, I don't know, around 80% of the population is for normalization of relation with U.S. They are critical here and there about the U.S. past policies toward Iran, but broadly speaking, they support normalization, and a normalization that will be mutually beneficial. So I think that the people will support this movement, and if the president was to use these people, then we will get this process going forward. Otherwise, if Rafsanjani or Khamenei or Moin was to do what President Khatami did, that is, to get the boat but not use it, then I think they will fail, because the conservative is not going to easily give up on this normalization, particularly now that they are not in power, or in executive power. And it's unfortunate that any time the group that is not in executive power is against this relationship, and the one who is in the executive power is for it. But in this particular case, the situation is going to change, I believe. I think we have come to a point where it has become almost inevitable that the U.S. and Iran negotiate. There is a strategic imperative from both sides for this negotiation and normalization.
Thank you, Dr. Amir Ahmadi. We are at the end of the time that we have for tonight, and I would like to invite you to join us in future time. Meanwhile, I know that your council, the American-Iranian Council, has a website, and you send out some briefs and talking point summaries every week. If you can...
Yeah, we have this www.american-iranian.org. So www.american-iranian.org. And that's the website, and that if your colleagues wanted to know more about me, my website personal is www.amirahmadi.com. AmirAhmadi.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Shane, for being with us tonight. And again, I hope we can have you for a future show. Thank you.
Well, it will be a pleasure, and I will look forward to talking to you again. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.